Earl Guthrie wrote this song, Alice's Restaurant, more than half a century ago, and there's still nothing else quite like it. And it's unlikely he will leave it out of the concerts he's going to be doing in Australia in a few weeks' time. We thought we'd take the opportunity of his forthcoming visit to listen again to an interview that I recorded with him in a slightly noisy hotel foyer in Wollongong a few years ago.
This song's called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant, that's just the name of the song. And that's why I called the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago, it was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant, she lives in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we came to a side road, and off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff, and at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile's better than two little piles, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. And that's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning when we got a phone call from Officer Obie.
Arlo Guthrie, you grew up at the centre of both a musical and political movement, where presumably your home was filled with what I suppose today we would call icons of the time. Was there ever any danger that you were going to grow up to be an accountant or a dentist?
Well, today, you know, to tell you the truth, when I was a kid growing up, there were very few people who were actually making a living singing folk songs. Most of these guys were people who, in their early lives, you know, when you think about Lead Belly, you think about some of these other guys, were musicians, but they also had regular jobs. It wasn't until the interest in preserving the sort of regional culture that came about as a result of the Lomaxes and some of the others who went around finding songs. Everyone realized at some point that the world was becoming larger and that there was a sort of globalization, to use a modern word, going on, and that some of these cultural diverse styles of music were being lost. The people that knew them were dying off. And so there was this rush to go out and save them, to collect them. And out of that, simultaneously grew a sort of interest, not just an interest, but a reverence for these kind of regional dialects, the regional songs. Up to that point, they weren't considered serious. They were, you know, these were just local, these were not Broadway, this was not Tin Pan Alley, as we used to call it. These were guys that were making music that was popular maybe in their little part of the world, but had no value in the sort of larger commercial recording entertainment industry world. And so there grew, at the same time that the songs were being saved, there came a reverence for and an appreciation for the culture in which they had blossomed. And that is what really started this whole sort of, folk music wasn't even a term that people used in those days. This was regional music. My interest in it grew out of that. I mean, this was not a political thing. This was not a social thing. This was just an honest attempt to recapture or to keep alive the root music that had given the modern culture all of this diversity, out of which had come a pop culture and some other stuff around the world. So you have to see it in that context. I mean, I'm not an academic, but if you understand what I'm saying, we were learning songs from Appalachia. We were learning songs from the Deep South. We were learning with square dances and stuff like that, all of which had no relevance at all to the modern world. It was just that we loved it. And the characters that came out of it, the Mississippi John Hurt kind of guys, were so wonderful as human beings, let alone the music. Even if they never played music, some of these guys were worth knowing because they were just lovely people. I mean, wonderful hearts, great spirits, and not only that, but they could play. And they had written songs, or they were carrying on bits of songs that they had remembered. And we fell in love. When I say we, people of my age, we used to go down to hear these guys and loved the guys. The music was almost secondary. And it was just out of this personal relationship to all of these kinds of people that we started playing their stuff. And later on, of course, it developed into the 60s, what we used to call the folk scare or the folk boom or whatever, you know. And all of a sudden there were these college kids wearing sweaters, you know, singing all of these songs that had nothing to do with where they came from or who they were. And people sort of looked at that oddly and said, well, why are those college students playing songs from Appalachia or coal mining ballads or something like that? And there was a whole generation of people that just didn't get it. But on the other hand, there were a bunch of people who fell in love with the sound of the banjo and the mandolin and the fiddle and the guitar styles, from Elizabeth Cotton to Doc Watson to even Gene Autry and people like that. And I was one of those kids. I just fell in love with it all. And later on, I found that I could actually make a living doing this, but this was not an idea of I'll become a professional doing this. I just loved the stuff, and I loved playing it with my friends.
There's several things I'd like to pursue in what you just said, but the first one is, of course, that you weren't just a kid. You were Woody Guthrie's son. That must make a difference.
Well, I had access to places that people my age could not go to because most of this music was being played in clubs, and you had to be like 18 or over to get into them because they were all drinking, you know, establishments. But I was able to get in. And even as a kid, when I was 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, I would get in. Not only could I get in, but they would actually give me a drink. And much to my mother's horror, you know, all of these club owners would get that kid a drink, give him a brew or something, you know. And my mom would sit there saying, well, okay, well, you know, everybody else is having one. Why should I deprive my kid? And so I was going for the, you know, I was listening to the songs and I learned stuff from these guys. I would sit in the front row on a little in a little club somewhere and watch Cisco Houston and watch Ramblin' Jack, and I would go back afterwards because I had access to them, and I would say, show me how you're doing that. What are you doing? I cannot figure that out. And every one of these guys, including Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, all the blues guys, the country guys, the folk guys, they would all take time and say, well, you put your hand like this and you do that, and I was learning stuff. And so pretty soon I was like a hotshot, you know, among my own peers. I wasn't very good, but, you know, with a group of kids, when I had the access to it, I was the one that everybody was asking me then, well, how'd you learn to do that? And I would show all my friends. And so we all learned to play in this sort of hand-me-down tradition.
So you were able to say, well, I picked this up from Brownie McGee, actually.
Yeah, well, Brownie McGee was like an uncle to me. You know, Sonny and Brownie were good buddies of my dad's. Later on, I would take my friends because we all had access because I did. And a lot of the guys that I, you know, played with, who were in little bands together, had gone on since and done some wonderful things.
There are a lot of musicians today. Randy Newman is a good example, but you're certainly one of them, where you listen to the songs and you hear the whole history of American music. I mean, some of your songs are have a great debt to gospel. Some of them have a sort of New England hymnody there. Alice's Restaurant is ragtime. Yeah. Are you aware of this kind of eclecticism, I suppose, American eclecticism in your music?
Yeah, not only that, I love it. Because, you know, primarily my learning came from my dad's record collection. It didn't come from going out. I mean, I learned a lot going to these clubs and listening to people. But mostly my dad had an extensive collection of 78 records, you know, these old breakable records with a song on each side. I mean, it took up an entire wall. And I listened to it all, and I loved it all. I fell in love with ragtime piano, mostly because I didn't want to study the classical music lessons that I was taking lessons for. It just drove me crazy. I mean, why sit there and play Beethoven when you could sit there and listen to, you know, some great barrel house style, you know, keyboard? I fell in love with it. And later on, I loved Beethoven too. I mean, he came into it, and I would steal from him as well as anyone else. See, folk music to me is not a genre. It's the way that you learn the music you play. You learn it from somebody else. You learn it from a record. You learn it by ear. There's no course you take on it. I mean, now there may be, but in those days there certainly wasn't. There wasn't even a book written on it. As a matter of fact, even the Lomax books that went out and collected the songs, there weren't arrangements for songs in there. They just gave you the words and said, this is so-and-so sang this cowboy song. I met him in Wyoming. That's the end of the story. But on the records, you could hear it. And not only that, you could hear the history of the people in the songs. You could actually, in their voices, you could hear something that a book could never translate. You could hear the actual guys, and I love that.
I'm sitting in a slightly noisy bar in a Wollongong motel with Arlo Guthrie. Arlo, I began by saying that it was a musical and political movement that you were born into. Perhaps we should talk a bit about the politics, because you were talking there about the words of the songs. Some of your father's songs, like your own, are very funny. Some of them are more angry than funny. There's I think it's fair to say, a strong streak of sentimentality there as well. How do you know when you want to write a song about something, how do you know which is the best path to pursue, when humor will do the job or when you've got to be a bit more blunt?
I don't know that you ever actually know. There's a lot of songs that I've written that I've sung once and then put aside and said, well, that doesn't go over very well. You know, there were a lot of songs, even Alice's Restaurant, you know, when it first came out, there were people that said, shut up and sing, you know. And now we come over here to Australia and there are people saying, where's Alice's Restaurant? How come you're not doing that? I mean, there are always people who enjoy their own, the soundtrack to their life. You know, there's a moment in your life, if you're falling in love, whatever's playing on the radio becomes a part of your life. It's the soundtrack to your life. And when you want to rekindle that or you want to hear it again, it becomes a part of you. I, at some point, realized that I didn't want to make music that became a part of you that was nasty or that made you feel bad or that was angry in the long run. There were songs that I wrote like that because that's how I felt. I mean, I wrote songs about Nixon that I cringe when I hear it now, because as a human being, it's easy sometimes to kick somebody when they're down. But sometimes you have to separate what a person does and thinks from who they are. I mean, just because I got older and I got a little smarter, maybe. I didn't want the angry sort of young man songs to become a part of somebody else's soundtrack.
And in any case, a three-dimensional character works much better than a two-dimensional character in a song. I mean, I think one of the reasons that Alice's Restaurant is so successful is that You know, there are a couple of places in the song where you feel a bit sorry for Officer Obi because he's not very bright, and he's having all of these smart aleck comments made at him, and you see, occasionally you see it from his point of view, and that's why I think it lasts.
Well, not only that, you have to realize we write this song about this cop who arrests us, and it's easy to make fun of him. But 2 years after the record came out, we were making the movie about the song. And he's playing himself in the movie. And all of a sudden, this guy who, from a distance, it was easy to make fun of, is standing right in front of you. Now what do you do? He had the good humor and the kind heart to be able to put up with that in the movie, to make fun of himself. And that's when I realized, that at some point there, I realized, you know, I can't attack people personally. We can all make fun of a situation, but if you take yourself too seriously, or you take somebody else so seriously that it's easy to make somebody look stupid. That's not where I wanted to go, because what happened is I ended up being friends with him, and we became great buddies. He came to me one day after 2 weeks of working on the film. He said, "You know what? If you hippies can get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and work all day like we're doing, you can't be all that bad." And it's a lesson that needs to be learned these days. You know, we have a lot of enemies overseas that it's easy to make fun of, but someday they may be friends. And if we cut the line now and we make it impossible to be friends later on, we're doing ourselves a disservice.
A few years ago, I interviewed for the music show Tom Lehrer, and he said that round about the time that Henry Kissinger was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace was the time that he gave up satire, that he felt that it wasn't so easy to be funny anymore about world events. And it wasn't so easy, and this is sort of the other side of the same coin, and I guess it's partly what you're saying, it wasn't so easy to be black and white anymore, that there were so many issues that he wasn't completely sure what he really felt about. Is this something you've run up against, Arlo Guthrie?
My position, you know, in writing political stuff, is to, yeah, you have to take to task the people who make the decisions, but you have to take, it's the task you take to task, and you let the people work it out themselves individually, because in the long run of things, it would be better off for us all to see what we have in common and concentrate a little bit of our attention on that. Not everything. You can't exclude what's going on. You can't just ignore it. But you want to give somebody room to get out of the situation they're in, to change their mind, to become a friend. And if you do that, in the long run, history moves along quite nicely. The older I get, I don't know if that I'm getting any smarter, but you see things a little differently. I'll never forget one time, it was during the Vietnam War. Lyndon Johnson was president of the United States. He got us into this mess. And I was so angry, because first of all, they were trying to get me to go. I didn't want to go over there. I didn't understand the philosophy. And what they were telling us was, if we don't stop them commies over in Vietnam, they're going to be in New Jersey in 2 weeks. And I knew better than that, because no one was going to Jersey, even the people in the States. It was just a ridiculous assumption. Now it's years later, and we're all looking back and saying, what the heck was that all about? There's still no explanation for it. Well, we may have some views like this from hindsight on events that are going on now. And I'll never forget, it was when the Vietnam vets came home and started marching in the peace parades and the peace marches and the stuff like that. That's what ended it. It wasn't a bunch of hippies out there saying, oh, let's don't go. It was when everybody in one voice, those that had been there, those that had opposed it, those that supported it, began to slowly say, what are we doing? How is this serving anybody? That's when it fell apart. And we haven't seen that yet, because not enough time has gone by, but that doesn't mean it won't happen. And so to sit down and write songs, you know, about those bad soldiers or something, like, to me, is absurd, because that's where those are the guys who are putting their lives on the line that you need to have. Those are the voices of credibility. And when those guys speak up about what's happening, nobody can say anything else.
Perhaps, can I just ask you if you'd say a word about your mother, because everybody knows
Woody Guthrie, but your mother is not as world famous.
Well, oddly enough, there's a place in Perth that's named after her. And she was a dancer with the Martha Graham Company. She was a modern dancer. A lot of the music that she grew up with was classical. And so I had to study the classics when I was a kid. I had to listen to the radio and know, okay, which orchestra is that? Which composer? If I really knew something, it was which conductor, you know, all of that. And so I grew up on both sides of the fence. The back porch picking side and the well-trained classical side, and I have a little bit of both. But after my dad became ill with Huntington's disease, she really took it upon herself to organize the entire world. She was a very well-organized person, which in a family isn't necessarily a great thing, but for everybody else, it could be fabulous. She met doctors who knew very little about what Huntington's was. So she ended up knowing more about the disease than the doctors who were supposedly treating my dad. And she decided this just isn't right. Let's find out what's going on. And so she went around the world and she organized people in every little town where there was a family, where a couple of families or a person with this disease. And she discovered that it was a worldwide thing. A lot of the misconceptions about the disease began to perish just because the light had been focused on it. And one of the things that she did back in the States was, at that time, different funding for all of these diseases, muscular dystrophy, you know, all these other things, all of these groups were at each other's throats vying for the same dollars to fix their disease, to work on their disease, to have wheelchairs for their patients. And she said, why are we all against each other? Why don't we just join each other, go to the Congress of the United States as one voice, and say, we all need these things, so that if you have an extra wheelchair in the multiple sclerosis fund, but we need one over at Huntington's, that we can get that wheelchair. Everybody doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. And so she went around the world and did that. And one of the places that was named after her is in Perth, and I'm going to try and visit while I'm there. And she left quite a legacy. And I wanted to include that legacy in this center that we call the Guthrie Center. And although we don't actually call it the Guthrie Center, we just call it the church, which is what we called it in the song, Alice's Restaurant. So here we are in this church, 1965. A couple of friends of mine owned this abandoned building. We took out their garbage, got arrested, wrote a song about it, made a movie in the very church where it happened with the real cast of characters that most, for the most part, played themselves. And then after the movie came out in 1969, all of my friends sort of, you know, went their separate ways. The church was sold and bought by other people over the years a few times. And around about 12 years ago, I was doing one of those Whatever Happened to Him TV shows, and we're filming outside the old church. I hadn't been back there in decades. And some people came running out saying, "That's Arlo Guthrie. Let's get him to buy it." And I thought, oh, man, that's the last thing I need is another mortgage or something. And I realized that I didn't need it for me, but maybe that would be the appropriate place to set up a center to continue the traditions that my parents had started. The idea of just taking care of each other, organizing each other, and just helping out, and just having one more place in the world where people are doing the stuff that needs to get done. It's not a big thing. You know, this is not a big organization. It's just a little joint out in the middle of nowhere. But out in the middle of nowhere, in this particular place, there's one more little spot that people can come together and do stuff that's important. And if enough people do those kinds of things, of course, the whole world would be fine.
Arlo Guthrie, we're about to take a big, deep breath and listen to Alice's Restaurant. As you said, you recorded in 1967, and which is the year your father Woody Guthrie died, but he lived long enough to hear a test pressing of the song. What did he think of it?
Well, that's the family joke, of course, that he heard it and died. So, you know, we don't know what he thought of it.
I think he would have approved. Arlo Guthrie, it's been a great pleasure to meet you and talk to you. Thanks for giving up half an hour of your morning.
No problem at all.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant and walk out. You know, if one person, just one person does it, they may think he's really sick and they won't take him. And if two people do it in harmony, they think they're both faggots and it won't take either of them. And if three people do it, can you imagine three people walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out? They may think it's an organization. And can you imagine 50 people a day? I said 50 people a day walking in, singing a bar, Alice's restaurant, and walking out. And friends, they may think it's a movement. And that's what it is. The Alice's Restaurant Anti-Massacre Movement. And all you gotta do to join is to sing it the next time it comes around on the guitar with feeling. So we'll wait till it comes around on the guitar here. Sing it when it does. Here it comes. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
That was horrible.
Want to end war and stuff, you gotta sing loud. You could put a lot. I've been singing the song now for 25 minutes. I could sing it for another 25 minutes. I'm not proud or tired. So we'll wait till it comes around again. And this time with four-part harmony and feeling. We're just waiting for it to come around, is what we're doing. All right now.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant,
excepting Alice.
You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. So walk right in, it's around the back, and just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Da 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 da. At Alice's restaurant.